In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Hello, and welcome to Life of the Week, where leading historians delve into the lives of some of history's most intriguing and significant figures. From ancient Egyptian pharaohs and medieval warriors to daring 20th century spies. In 1603, James VI of Scotland succeeded Elizabeth I to become the King of England too, earning him the title James VI and I. Joe Ellis, who's writing a PhD on the King's Court at the University of York, joined us to delve into the life of this Stuart monarch, his raucous courts and his royal favourites, as well as his family life and obsession with witches. Joe was speaking with Eleanor Evans.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Joe, thank you so much for joining me. It would be great to start, please, with a bit of a potted history of the king himself. When was he ruling and how might people know of him already?
Absolutely. So James VI and I was born in 1566 in Edinburgh Castle, and he was the son of the famous Mary Queen of Scots and her less famous husband, second husband, actually, Lord Darnley, who died just a few months after James was born in a mysterious, and it has to be said, convenient at the time, gunpowder explosion. The controversy surrounding Darnley's death, particularly the implication that Mary was involved and her shotgun wedding to the Earl of Bothwell shortly after, meant that she was forced to abdicate and flee to England, and James never saw his mother again. As a result, James became King of Scotland at only 13 months old, so he was very much a cradle king. And he was King of Scotland for 36 years before he succeeded to the English throne upon the death of Elizabeth I in 1603. That made him the first King of Scotland, England and Ireland until his death in 1625. Despite his achievements, his reign has been rather overshadowed, I think, by the glamour of his Tudor predecessors and the drama of his mother's life and his son's life, King Charles I, who was also beheaded actually during the English Civil Wars. Nevertheless, he did preside over some of the most significant political and cultural events in British history. The gunpowder plot, the witch hunting craze, colonisation in America, and the success of William Shakespeare. So he's absolutely fascinating, both as a king and as a person.
Wonderful. So we're going to get into a lot of those elements today, but we'll go back to the beginning. You've already alluded to the very dramatic early years and the events surrounding his early reign. Can you take us back to those earliest years? What was his childhood like? And what was it like when he assumed the throne at this early age?
Absolutely. So, like I said, he was a cradle king. He was 13 months old, and that's a very dangerous position to be in the early modern period, physically and also politically. But he was also effectively an orphan when he became king. His father was dead and his mother was imprisoned. And in fact, she was, of course, executed herself by Elizabeth I in 1587. I think we can get an impression of a rather sort of lonely child who was really being trained for the role of Protestant kingship that lay ahead. The decision was made to raise James under the guardianship of the Earl and Countess of Mar, and he spent many, many years with them at Stirling Castle, whilst a succession of regents ruled Scotland in his name. The Countess of Mar really became the closest thing to a mother that James ever really knew. And there's some very, very poignant letters that James wrote to the Countess of Mar around this time, where he refers to her as Lady Minnie. That was his kind of pet name for his surrogate mother. So in this sense, he had kind of a stable, if somewhat lonely, childhood. However, at a very young age, he was also put under the strict tuition of the humanist and staunchly Protestant scholar George Buchanan, who subjected James to regular beatings, and I think it's fair to say was no fan of James's Catholic mother Mary, who he had also tutored at an early age. But Buchanan, I think, did instill in James a real lifelong passion for literature, theology, writing and learning, which actually served him very well in the years to come. Buchanan also strongly believed that there should be limitations on monarchy. But what this did to James was actually have the opposite effect. And James grew up to believe that he was God's representative on earth. So I think it's kind of really down to Buchanan that he became something of a scholar king. And James actually came of age into his majority at 12 years old. But at 12, he was very much still a child taking the reins of government. And he was left almost at the mercy of the Scottish nobility, whose factional sparring and feuding made his time in Scotland a particularly turbulent one. So as a teenager, he had to navigate various kidnap attempts, some of which were successful. The Rivon Raid in 1582, for example, was perpetrated by a coup of noblemen who wanted to rule in James's name, and they effectively put the king under house arrest, which is quite unbelievable. Later in Scotland, there were some also close call attempts on his life. He was nearly stabbed in the Earl of Gowrie's house, and it was only his page who saved him from that. So James's early life is very much tied up with wrestling control over the combative Scottish church and nobility, something that he actually did with a reasonable amount of success by the time he became King of England.
So you painted there a very unstable childhood and minority for James. Before we get to when he accedes to the throne of England, which obviously comes much later, can we pick up on this question of religion? Because it's obviously a time of great religious upheaval and dissent in Scotland and England at this time, and, well, the rest of Britain. I think religion's really important. Can you explain for our listeners the question of religion in James's upbringing and life? What religion was he?
Absolutely. So James was actually born a Catholic and baptised with the Catholic ceremony that was very much favoured by his mother, herself a Catholic. James's reign came into fruition at 13 months old because of the issues around the Scottish Reformation at the time. And Mary, of course, was a Catholic. And that was one of the reasons why she was forced to flee in the midst of this Scottish Reformation in the 1560s. However, James himself was brought up a very staunch Protestant under George Buchanan and under the Presbyterian Church government in Scotland. And he really remained Protestant for the rest of his life. Nevertheless, I would also say that he was a peacemaker king, and he really did have a firm belief in Christian unity, which led to a really strong distrust of religious extremists at both ends of the scale. So he was very distrustful of very strong Catholics and Puritans on the other end of the religious spectrum. Of course, the Gunpowder Plot of 1605 did very little to endear his Catholic subjects to him, of course. And after that, we do see some hardening in James's attempts at religious toleration. But I think what we find overall is that when it was politically expedient, James kind of courted Protestant and Catholic subjects and Protestant and Catholic foreign powers, for example, in Spain and France. And this public flexibility was particularly useful during his time in Scotland, when he played Catholics off against Protestants to put pressure on Scottish church leaders and really to keep Elizabeth I guessing about what he was doing in Scotland and what his foreign policy was and which direction he was moving in. So I think he was pragmatic in terms of religious practicalities, but certainly very secure in his personal Protestant religious belief.
You've mentioned how this informs his rule, but I wonder if we can just go a little bit more into James the young man at this stage. How can we characterise that before we get into what happens a bit later on?
So James was a very secure young man in his kingship. He had an extreme amount of difficulty in Scotland. Like I said, he was constantly trying to gain some kind of authority over his feuding Scottish nobility. And this really set him up for what was to come in England when a lot of the English elite was against him and his actions and his foreign policy. So as a young man in Scotland, he was very much fighting all the time. And there's some allusions to, in quite recent academic work, about him being a coward. And I really, really don't think that's the case at all. I mean, he was very looking towards putting the nobility under his thumb. And this was something that he couldn't really do in England in the same way that he had in Scotland. The political landscape was just so different. So I think as a young man growing up, he was very sure in himself, but not at all sure of those around him. And this really affected him for the rest of his life. And it's one of the reasons why he kept certain people very, very close to him. And he's very much known as the king with the favourites, Robert Carr and Buckingham. So yes, he was very much learning how to be a king. And I actually think he did it very successfully in Scotland.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
The holidays have arrived early with Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale. Upgrading window coverings can be a minor project with a major impact. Blinds.com makes it easy and affordable. Browse premium blinds, shades, shutters. We have your patio covered too. And get unlimited window treatments installed for one low cost. Free shipping and Blinds.com's 100% satisfaction guarantee. Shop Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale now. Save up to 45% plus premium doorbusters. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Great, well that sets us up nicely for what's to come. So we've got a great sense of James there as a child in his early years and as a ruler in Scotland as well. Now, listeners who know their Tudor family tree well might have already clocked the links here, but for listeners who don't know James the Sixth and to be first as well, how were Elizabeth and James the First related, Elizabeth the First of England that is, and how did he come to the English throne?
So, James was Elizabeth's cousin of sorts, through his descent from the first Tudor king, Henry VII. So they kind of came down different lines. Elizabeth was Henry VII's granddaughter, and James was Henry VII's great-grandson through the marriage of Margaret Tudor to James IV of Scotland. So basically, Henry VIII's sister Margaret married a Scottish king. Her line ends at this point with James VI. And then on the other side, Henry VIII, we have Elizabeth I. So I think it's something like they're second cousins or second cousins once removed, or I'm not exactly sure exactly how they're related. I did try and work it out once, but it's quite complicated. But effectively, they're cousins and they see each other as cousins and they actually refer to each other as brother and sister. James and Elizabeth never met. She never met Mary, Queen of Scots either, despite what the film says. But they did start an extensive correspondence around 1585. And in that correspondence, we can really see a kind of tumultuous relationship between the two. Despite the fact that they referred to each other as brother and sister, they really did fight sometimes like brother and sister. They were often at loggerheads. There's lots and lots of reasons for this tension, not least because, of course, Elizabeth had in fact executed James's own mother. But Elizabeth was very keen to make sure that Scotland was firmly in England's pocket, rather than in the pocket of France, where it traditionally placed itself. And this was something that James, as a reigning monarch in his own right, was really only willing to countenance when it suited him. And if he thought he could get some money, the subsidy from Elizabeth, then he very much moved towards Elizabeth and England. If he felt like he was going to be getting support from elsewhere, maybe in France, even in Spain, he would move towards them. Like I said earlier, he very much did keep Elizabeth guessing about his foreign policy. But to go back to the question, Elizabeth's famous refusal to name James as her heir is what caused the most friction between them. James definitely had an eye on England and the English succession from very early on. There's even accounts of James visiting the borders of England and Scotland just to simply look across the border into the southern kingdom that he so desperately wanted to be his. But at the time, before 1603, when James did accede to the English throne, there were other candidates for the English throne. Arbella Stuart, for example, was another cousin of the two. And some Englishmen actually preferred the idea of Arbella succeeding after Elizabeth because she was English. And there was kind of a split in England about whether James should actually succeed Elizabeth at all. So what he had going for him was he was male. And in the patriarchal society and the way that monarchy was viewed, a male ruler was eminently more desirable than a female ruler. He also had a sort of ready-made family that he had in Scotland. So some people were kind of, let's have an English-born monarch. And others were, no, let's have a male monarch with an heir and a spare and a daughter who could be married off into Europe, which she was. So it wasn't really until James started a secret and quite dangerous correspondence with Elizabeth's minister, Robert Cecil, in around 1601, that he really started to feel secure that the succession, that his succession was really going to happen. And ultimately, when Elizabeth did die in March 1603, it was actually quite a peaceful changeover from Tudor to Stuart.
That's really interesting to hear. I wonder if we can linger on that a little bit, the actual, you know, shift of power, how it is received both in Scotland and England as well. How can that be characterised?
Again, there was very much a split between Scotland and England. Scotland was very happy that they were almost giving their king to England. They were quite happy about doing that. They thought that it raised their prestige on the European stage. They were also quite happy about the practical benefits that delivering James to England might get Scotland. So the trading benefits, the fact that they would be able to become perhaps naturalised as English subjects and have all the benefits that that would bring. In England, it was certainly less well received. The actual process of receiving James into England on the progress that he made southbound in 1603, he was very much subjected to the standard glorification of the new king that you might generally expect when that happens. After the progress, when James actually started doing stuff, sort of rearranging his household and trying to get a more parliamentary union between England and Scotland, that is when the English kind of turned perhaps a little bit against him. And they were also worried at the outset about this wave of Scots moving into England, which was something to worry about, and especially at the court, because they didn't want to be ousted by these new Scottishmen that James brought down with him. And of course, Scotland had to deal then with an absentee monarch for the rest of James's life. And actually, there hasn't been a resident Scottish monarch since. So they had to deal with an absentee monarch. And in one way, that was quite good for them because it relieved the costs and the absolute massive amount of debt that James had given the court and the government of Scotland. But in some ways, they were kind of left to their own devices, and it was more difficult to get things done because they had to wait for replies from England. Again, on the other hand, perhaps that might have been good for them. They were given a little bit more free rein. So James's accession was both lauded at the time, and people were quite unsure about it at the same time, I think.
Great. That's a really great sense of what this shared monarchy means in real terms. I did want to pick up on something you mentioned before about him having a ready-made family, meaning he was a suitable candidate for this position as King of England. Can we go into that family? Who was he married to? Who were his children?
So James was married to a Danish princess called Anne of Denmark. I prefer to call her Anna of Denmark because that's how she referred to herself. And they were married in 1589. James actually left Scotland, which was quite a controversial thing to do, for 6 whole months in order to collect Anna from Denmark personally, which was kind of a really bold thing to do at the time. He just left his country and it was quite controversial. The issue was that Anna was actually finding it physically difficult to get to Scotland. There were storms battering her back all the time. And James ultimately was just really impatient. He'd been under pressure for a long time to get married. And he really, really wanted this marriage to happen. And Anna of Denmark was a fantastic catch, if you like. Suitors from all over Europe were seeking her hand in marriage. And James certainly favoured Denmark for a marriage alliance, because it was a country of the reformed religion, and practically it was a profitable trading partner for Scotland, and as he hoped, later England too. So Anna was actually only 14 when she married James. They married by proxy before James actually physically went to collect her from Denmark, and she was only 14 and she couldn't speak the language when she arrived in Scotland, but she was a really remarkably quick learner. And she soon, well, it wasn't long at all before she started to involve herself in kind of Scottish factional intrigues at court, sometimes working in the interests of her husband and sometimes against his interests and for her own interests. So she did have a reasonable amount of agency at the Scottish court. Despite her working against James sometimes, he was actually usually very quick to forgive Anna. Even she accidentally shot his favourite dog once, and everyone expected him to fly into an absolute rage. And he surprised everyone by immediately forgiving Anna and actually giving her some jewels, I believe. Not as a reward, of course, but just to show how close they were. So there seems to have been some kind of genuine affection between the two in Scotland and in the early years of their marriage. And of course, during this time, they had 3 children who survived infancy. I think Anna was pregnant 7 times over the course of her life, but only 3 of those children survived. That was Henry, Prince of Wales, who died of typhoid in 1612. So he predeceased both his mother and his father, which was very sad. He was, in fact, a very popular prince, and people were really, really interested and wanting him to be the king after James. The English were really keen that this sort of warlike prince, the opposite of his peace-loving father, was going to take the reign after him. So it was very much a tragedy for them and a tragedy for James and Anna, obviously, too. Princess Elizabeth, who became Queen of Bohemia, who was very much bound up in the 30 Years' War that started in 1618. She was the Winter Queen, I believe is her name that she's known as. She was very important as a diplomatic tool for James. Although that sounds incredibly harsh, that's what she was. She wasn't going to become Queen of England, but she became Queen of Bohemia and had a really important place on the European stage. And finally, of course, we have little Prince Charles, who would later become King Charles I, of beheading and English Revolution fame. So after they moved to England, they had their three children, but the couple, James and Anna, increasingly found themselves kind of moving in separate spheres. They had separate households and they were pursuing separate interests. It was said at the time that James was the hunting king and Anna was the dancing queen, which is a fantastic contemporary reference to the ABBA song, due to her love of court masks. So it was kind of a relationship that split apart. And I think the bigger realm of the English court enabled them to do that. And they went on their own separate progresses. They travelled separately, sometimes together, but sometimes separately. And Anne and James very much looked towards their own interests. One of these interests for James, of course, was his favourites.
Okay, well, let's get into that then. You mentioned his travelling court and the royal progresses. I wonder if you can take us into the nature of these a little bit more, perhaps how they differed from Elizabeth I's reign. How did he change the shape of the royal court in this time? What did it look like?
So when James moved to England, he somewhat picked up where Elizabeth had left off. He kept many of the same privy councillors, although he did add some Scottish councillors to his council on his journey down towards England and towards London. But what he increasingly started to do was pack his court with Scottish courtiers, really pack it full of Scottish courtiers. And this was particularly noticeable in the bedchamber, the real inner sanctum of royal life, where only very few courtiers were allowed to be. And initially, most of these courtiers that James added to that bedchamber were Scottish. The bedchamber was somewhere where everybody wanted to be if they wanted to get ahead. Now, this, of course, did not go down very well at all with his new English courtiers. I also think that James's court has something of a reputation for kind of drunken debauchery, in a way. There's lots of references to these sort of wild parties that were held at court, which is something quite different from the entertainments that Elizabeth staged in her court. They were big and they were glamorous, but I don't think they were raucous. One courtier described James's court as if the devil was contriving every man to blow himself up by wild riot and excess, which I think really sums up what this court was like. However, this wasn't particularly unusual at early modern courts across Europe, and monarchs did have to maintain the image of conspicuous consumption as a display of prestige and power. So it is true that it was perhaps quite raucous. I'm not sure whether debauched is the way to approach it. What is true, however, is the contemporary claim that James and his court rarely stayed in one place for very long. And that is absolutely true. And that's been demonstrated to me through my own research. He was constantly on the move, in perpetual motion. And he certainly saw more of England as a Scottish king than most of his Tudor predecessors. Elizabeth's progresses tended to stay around the home counties. James was constantly travelling up and down what would become the M1. He made the extensive journey from Edinburgh to London in 1603, which he really took his time on because he wanted Elizabeth's funeral to be over before he reached London so that he could have all the attention on himself. And he returned to Scotland for the first and last time in 1617 on a giant, enormous progress, which lasted 6 months and took him all across England and Scotland. And in between those two big progresses, the court actually went on progress every year. James made the same amount of progresses as Elizabeth in half the amount of time in his time in England. And of course, Elizabeth's very famous for her royal journeys, but I think it's important to note that James also had a very business-like approach to making these progresses. He was also constantly just flitting off on hunting holidays with his favourites, most of whom were Scottish, which was again deeply unpopular with the English courtiers. So ultimately, there was a lot of complaint at the time that James and his court just simply wasn't there in London where many thought it should be. The advantages, on the other hand, were that the daily costs of the court could be offloaded onto those who had the dubious pleasure of hosting the court. And James could display his authority to the masses, socialise with those who he counted, and perhaps, on the other side, giving his hosts the chance to ask the king a favour. So I think it's true that James was perhaps not as comfortable in the spotlight as Elizabeth I, but he certainly used his court as a kind of travelling advert for his kingship in very much the same way that she did.
And you mentioned the dubious pleasure of hosting. Is that just to do with the cost or the sheer sort of upheaval of having these people arrive en masse?
Absolutely, both. The sheer cost, the competition between progress hosts was incredibly fiery. Insane amounts of money were spent on hosting the king. And it really was just an opportunity for them to get the king in a kind of social one-on-one, an opportunity to have a real conversation with the king where they could ask him a favour. So sometimes it was worth the outlay on hosting the king, and sometimes it wasn't. There were some courtiers who hosted the king who never received any kind of favour whatsoever and were left very much out of pocket. So yes, it was a dubious pleasure. James obviously very much enjoyed it because he just had to sit there and enjoy everything that people were laying on top of him.
These raucous parties and so on. Sounds good. Great. So some people who definitely did have the ear of the king are his favourites. Can we turn to these men? What was the nature of James's personal relationship with them, and how would they have been understood at the time, and how should we perhaps characterise them now?
Yes. So James certainly enjoyed the company of handsome male courtiers. When he was only 13 years old, the absence of his own family, I think, led James to call Esme Stuart, his cousin, back to Scotland from France. Esme was much older than James at 37, and he was something of an exotic presence at court who fascinated the young king. And he was showered with rewards. He was made the only duke in Scotland at the time. But he was deeply unpopular at court because he was French and also Catholic. However, I think what we see here is the beginning of a pattern emerging where James was facilitating the rise of a favourite and who later had a rather catastrophic fall or were actually damaging to James's own reputation. So in England, Robert Carr was a Scottish favourite who travelled to England with James and enjoyed much favour until his implication in a court poisoning, which led to his downfall. Most famously, George Villiers, the Duke of Buckingham, had an unprecedented rise to power that continued into the early reign of Charles I. Now, the nature of these relationships between James and his favourites, so really what was happening behind the closed doors of the bedchamber, is almost unknowable because there's no real hard evidence. However, many at the time and now suspect that they were sexual in nature. Sexual acts between men were reasonably common at the time, but I think we have to be careful here about transferring modern concepts of sexual identity onto early modern people. The concepts of homosexuality and bisexuality, for example, they simply didn't exist in the 16th and 17th centuries. It was very much seen as a physical act, as opposed to how we would see it now, a kind of partnership in the sense that we see it now. Men were friends, and this is often how it was viewed by contemporaries. Nevertheless, James was very much known to kiss and caress his favourites in public. And perhaps the juiciest bit of evidence that we've got that there was perhaps something physical going on between James and Buckingham is a letter from Buckingham where he mentions that he shall never forget at Farnham when they were on progress, when the bed's head could not be found between the master and his dog. Now, there's quite a few ways that you could take this, but I think that certainly does suggest some kind of physicality between the two. But on the other hand, James was vehement that laws be put into place against the act of sodomy itself. He strengthened the laws that Henry VIII had made. And of course, he did father several royal children. So evidently, he was able to rise to the occasion, I suppose, when with Queen Anna, when necessary. There was actually also some interesting rumours during his time in Scotland that he had a mistress. Agnes Murray, which is something that doesn't get spoken about enough, I don't think. And whilst this was unlikely to have been a sexual relationship with the young Agnes Murray, it was actually more likely to be an exercise in political spin to demonstrate the king's virility and masculinity. But I think it needs to be remembered that this is how James viewed his kingship, and this is what he had to do. He had to sort of invent a mistress, if that was the case, to display his kingship in that way. So James and his favourites, to sum up, certainly enjoyed a political partnership. They acted as a bridge between the king and his army of suitors that constantly badgered him. But I also think it's likely, based on the very small amount of evidence available, that the relationships between James and his favourites were more than platonic.
It's such an interesting and clearly complicated picture, and I guess just steering clear of labels in these situations seems quite important.
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, so moving on then to another aspect of James's reign, something that came perhaps more prominent later on, was his role in witch hunting and his feelings on witchcraft. What can you tell us about this?
James's feelings on witchcraft is one of the things that he's probably most famous for, and one of the things that most often gets people excited about James. Although, obviously, we have to bear in mind that some of these witch trials were absolutely brutal. And in Scotland in particular, where James's obsession began, they were extremely, extremely brutal. And I think that's important to remember that whenever we talk about these witch trials. You know, it's more than just hocus pocus. This was a real human experience. But James's obsession with witchcraft began in 1590 on the journey back from Denmark with his new queen. The ships were battered by severe storms and they had to shelter in Norway for a few weeks before continuing back to Scotland. During this time, it was suggested by somebody to James that witchcraft had been the cause of these issues and that his enemies were really trying to prevent him from returning to Scotland. So when they did return to Scotland, more than 100 suspected witches in North Berwick were arrested. And several actually confessed to having met with the devil and devoted themselves to doing evil, including acts such as poisoning the king, members of his household, and attempting to sink the king's ship, as James suspected. But it has to be remembered that these confessions were extracted under torture. Over the next few years, James personally attended a number of witch trials, and it's said that he even supervised the torture of some women accused of witchcraft, which is obviously barbaric if it's under torture and problematic. So this is certainly not a glimmering moment, I don't think, in James's kingly career. But his obsession really came to a head in 1597, when he published his own book, Demonology, that detailed his abhorrence for the practice of dark magic. However, incredibly, it was only a couple of years later that James actually appears to have kind of lost interest in the subject of witchcraft. And he became a bit more sceptical about the realities of witchcraft. For example, he continued to attend witch trials, but many of these were dismissed by James personally as examples of fakery. He even started admonishing a number of judges for being too trusting in the accusations that they were hearing. So I think James certainly played a significant role in the widespread victimisation of accused witches. And the influence of his published work and his actions in the 1590s really ensured that this victimisation continued long after he personally became sceptical of the practice.
It's a significant legacy, isn't it? And another event that looms large in James's life, which you've already alluded to and listeners will probably be familiar with as well, is the gunpowder plot, another aspect of these broad religious divisions at the time. Can you take us into this event and what impact it had on the king?
So, as most of your listeners probably know, but some may not, the gunpowder plot was a Catholic plot in 1605 that aimed to blow up the Houses of Parliament. And within the Houses of Parliament was the majority of the royal family and the institution of government of England and Scotland. So if it had succeeded, it would have been absolutely devastating on a human level and on a political level. The plan was actually to place Elizabeth, Princess Elizabeth, James's daughter, on the throne, who was staying elsewhere. So she wasn't included in the Houses of Parliament. But the plot was, of course, thwarted. And James was very much, again, placing himself in the situation of the discoverer of the plot, which I think those who actually did discover the plot, Robert Cecil had quite a lot of input in this, allowed him to do so that he could kind of be the saviour of himself and the English government. The impact of the gunpowder plot on James, and in fact on Catholics, was quite strong. James was used to being a very open king. When he travelled around, he spoke to people that he met in the fields, and he spoke to people that weren't necessarily Protestant. He was very willing to entertain religious debate on progress and when he was outside of the palace. After 1605, of course, this very much stopped, albeit not for very long. He did kind of bring that around again, but this kind of stopped. And this is when James starts to look a bit like a monarch who doesn't want to engage with his people in the same way that Elizabeth I did. The gunpowder plot was basically a retaliation against what James had been doing in the fields when he was speaking to these Catholics before 1605. So when he met Catholics and Puritans, he was very much promising, to an extent, some kind of toleration. Now, by 1605, when that hadn't happened, you start to get more vehement opposition from Puritans against James. And then you also end up with the Catholics attempting to perpetrate the gunpowder plot. So it was quite important for James to acknowledge it. Obviously, we still celebrate every year on the 5th of November, and it has a real legacy, but it was really important at the time for James to remind everyone that this happened to him and it shouldn't be forgotten that Catholics were the perpetrators.
So clearly a significant event there. And we've talked about many of the sort of touchstones of his life, and I'm sure there's plenty more to say. But for the purposes of this episode, we should probably start wrapping up a little on James's life. So I wonder if, Joe, you could take us into the king's final years and death.
James died on the 27th of March, 1625, at one of his favourite standing houses and hunting lodges. So actually next year is the 400th anniversary of James's death. Up to that point, he was actually the longest reigning monarch the British Isles had seen. He'd been King of Scotland for 57 of his 58 years. So he was relatively young by today's standards, but he'd been king nearly all his life. The presence of the Duke of Buckingham at his deathbed suggested to some that the king had actually been murdered by his favourite, in order to hasten the accession of King Charles. But I think evidence for this is lacking, and it seems more likely that this was a rumour started by Buckingham's many enemies. He was certainly wildly unpopular by this point, and was actually assassinated himself in 1628. I think it's more widely accepted that James had an attack of dysentery and perhaps a stroke. Indeed, James's later years had really been marred by increasingly painful arthritis, gout, kidney stones. And because of his frail health, he was really an increasingly peripheral figure at court and on the political stage. So in his final years, he rarely visited London. He preferred to stay at his hunting lodges around Cambridgeshire, Hertfordshire. And we find Prince Charles really beginning to play a much more significant role in policy making and direct government at this time. So I think it's being the 400 year anniversary of King James's death next year, I think we'll probably be hearing a little bit more about him. And of course, we have the biopic of George Villiers, which I hope is going to show James in kind of a new perspective, but we shall see.
Yeah, we shall see. I'm sure some listeners will enjoy digging into that drama and discovering James anew as well. So with this big anniversary in mind coming up, I guess, can you leave listeners with your sense of the legacy of James VI and First?
So I think James's legacy is particularly long lasting, actually, and very relevant to our own society in Britain today. So the impact of the Union of the Crowns has political ramifications with regards to current debates around Scottish independence and devolution. Culturally, the King James Bible, which he commissioned, is still used today. And he was a patron of Shakespeare's theatre company, the King's Men. In fact, much of the background material that Shakespeare used for Macbeth was based on James's personal involvement in the witch trials. It should be said that the first permanent English colony in the Americas was established in Jamestown, Virginia, during his reign. But I think we should also acknowledge that on the other side of that, in 1619, the first recorded African slaves arrived in America, very nearby the Jamestown colony. But James's personal legacy, I suppose, there's lots of popular myths about James being an idle king, being a coward, being a slobbering kind of lech. But these largely come from the writings of his enemies, particularly a man named Anthony Weldon, former servant of James, who was kicked out of court and had this vendetta against James for the rest of his life. And unfortunately, that's what a lot of people see James as now. Like I said, I'm hoping that the biopic is going to take into account some of the new perspectives. So his pragmatic and sometimes wily intelligence, his wit and his sense of humour. I think he was certainly not the fusty old authoritarian that some accounts suggest. And the personal attributes and style of his kingship that he exhibited in Scotland, I think would have actually served England really well. But I think the English didn't really understand his way of working and they didn't understand him as a person, which is perhaps why his reputation as a King of England is not quite as esteemed as it was in Scotland. So to sum up, I think, whilst he may not be known as a glamorous monarch, for sure, like Elizabeth I, or a tragic monarch like his mother, Mary Queen of Scots, I think his political and cultural contributions to British and world history, whether positive or negative, should really not be underestimated.
That was Jo Ellis. You can find out more about King James and the series Mary and George, which was mentioned in the conversation, at historyextra.com. And if you'd like to hear a conversation all about the real history that inspired the drama Mary and George, with its historical consultant Benjamin Woolley, just search for Mary and George on your podcast feeds.
Thanks for listening to today's Life of the Week. Be sure to join us again next time to learn about another fascinating figure from the past.